part 12 of 13 from set number 2005, introducing C.J. Jung's Red Book, a BC Recordings copyrighted presentation by Stefan Heller entitled Jung's Red Book, Appendix C.
And with that, I think we'll address ourselves now to the last part of the portion of the Red Book that is called Scrutinies, and we'll start looking into the text right now. After a brief conversation carried out by Philemon and Jung, because now in this last part here, Philemon seems to be practically all the time present, and after the departure of the dead to whom the seven sermons were delivered, another sequence of some importance follows. A dark form with golden eyes approaches, which initially frightens Jung, would frighten me too, and probably most of you, so that he inquires from the newcomer if he might be an enemy. The being states that he has come from the east and follows the shining fire, which he says is Philemon. So he followed Philemon from the east. Replying to Jung's question, the Dark One states that he brings what is translated as abstinence. Maybe a little bit too critical here because of my German, and of course we don't have the original German of this part of the Red Book available to us, because Scrutinies is not in the calligraphic part of the book. So here we just have to guess what the German is. One of these days maybe it'll be available. In any event, he brings abstinence, which I feel from the context would probably be better be stated as abstention. Abstention from human joy and suffering. His message seems to be that of extolling a somewhat impersonal, universalized state and attitude toward human suffering and misery. This actually occurs a little later again, too. Among the potentially more controversial of his statements is his advocacy of pity. And here is the quotation, pity but no compassion. Pity for the world and a will held in check toward the other. Pity remains misunderstood, therefore it works. Far from longing, know no fear. Far from love, love the whole. And that's the extent of that particular quotation. Jung is disturbed by this, as perhaps we might be also, if it were addressed to us. And the golden-eyed being says that he comes with quiet pain and long peace. Well, I suppose if you have to have pain, it just might as well be quiet. He tells Jung that he comes to lay a cover of protection on him, namely on Jung, so that Jung will go to men as one veiled, and that thus his light will shine at night, just like the stars shine at night when the sun has set. Possibly a little indication here, a little inspirational indication that the material of the Red Book should not be at least immediately put into the open, but that Jung should carry on his mission veiled, which he did, of course. I don't think he understood at the time when this particular message was delivered to him that that is what it was all about, but it's very likely that that was the intention behind this communication. So Jung is not at all happy with this communication. As you may have noticed before, he has an argumentative and very personal streak in him, and he always questions and he frequently argues with the communications that come to him, which is probably not a bad example for us. one should not take the communications of the deeper world, whatever we call it, collective, unconscious, or otherwise, uncritically. One should take it attentively. One should take it with much scrutiny, but not necessarily uncritically. So Jung is not very happy with this communication, but the Dark One departs with the words, when he is called cruel by Jung, the simple is cruel. It does not unite with the manifold. Now we need to perhaps pay attention a little bit to some things here. One possible misunderstanding here again has, I think, linguistic aspects, and I hope you are not too tired of that, quibbling over words, because the German word for compassion is Mitleid, which means literally mit, along with, leid, suffering, suffering along with, which of course is the exact meaning of the Latin word compassio, suffering with. But while of course this is an exact translation, idiomatically Mitleid is, at least in my experience with the German language, more graphic, somewhat perhaps characterized by the banal phrase in English that we hear now and then, I feel your pain. Now, if a great being from the other world with shining golden eyes came to me and told me, you have to feel their pain, I would tell him, go someplace else. And start talking in a little more dignified fashion, you know. So there is a little difficulty here. So the dark being, I think, tries to desentimentalize such concepts, and he advocates attitudes of a more objective than subjective character. And that is why he advises Jung that inasmuch as suffering is universal, he ought to pity the suffering of humankind and not make it too personal, but rather direct his attention to the overall, the general condition, which is of course the way Buddha treated the matter, and who, as it became enshrined in Buddhism, was of course one of the greatest advocates of the need to recognize the universality of suffering and not to perhaps diffuse that too much by concentrating on individual incidents of suffering, but seeing it as a universal, always prevalent condition. I think we can readily understand that, because when we have, let's say, encounters with individual suffering, the temptation is always great to somehow find some specific cause, whether real or imagined. Oh well, this person is suffering for such and such. He smoked too much earlier on, or he did this or that, or it's a matter of bad heredity. Or if you want to be very highfalutin and kind of Asian about it, it's his karma. And you know what? Coming up with those statements hardly ever makes any suffering person feel better. And so I think it's very important to recognize that there are a certain afflictedness which pertains to the human condition. And it's not anyone's fault, but it's there. And so perhaps the remedies to these conditions also have to be sought in certain universals, as certainly Buddha advocated and as it is implied here. Also, some of these instructions to Jung seem to indicate that maybe he ought to watch as an individual his own emotional vulnerability that may arise as the result of transference, to use the technical term for it, as I'm sure that all therapists and analysts will agree, there is a certain danger of emotional vulnerability when dealing with people, and many a healer, whether a physical healer or a healer of psychological afflictions, has become contaminated with suffering and illnesses owing to the transference phenomenon. And so I think this being is warning Jung of that kind of a situation. Let us see now where we may proceed here. And now a new scene comes of some importance. When night fell, Philemon approached me in an earth-colored robe, holding a silver fish. "Look, my son," he said, "I was fishing and caught this fish. I bring it to you so that you may be comforted." Now, in what manner does the gift of a fish is supposed to comfort a person? Well, you know, you may try to figure that out yourselves. However, remember one thing. What is the fish, or who is the fish a symbol of? The ichthos. You even see it put on as little emblems on cars and things of that sort. It's the ancient Christian symbol for Christ. And as I looked at him astonished and questioningly, I saw that a shade stood in darkness at the door, bearing a robe of grandeur. The robe of grandeur, again, I think is something that we would idiomatically understand probably better as the robe of glory, known from certain scriptures. His face was pale, and blood had flowed into the furrows of his brow. But Philemon knelt down, touched the earth, and said to the shade, "My master and my brother, praised be your name. You did the greatest thing for us. Out of animals you made men. You gave your life for men to enable their healing. Your spirit was with us through an endlessly long time, and men still look to you and still ask you to take pity on them and beg for the mercy of God and the forgiveness of their sins through you. You do not tire of giving to men. I praise your divine patience. Are not men ungrateful? Does their craving know no limits? Do they still make demands on you? They have received so much, yet still they are beggars." I'm sure by now you are quite aware that he's speaking to Jesus. "Behold, my master and my brother, they do not love me, but they long for you with greed, for they also crave their neighbor's possessions." Well, they probably say, "Oh, Jesus Christ, you know, let me have the house of this guy over here. You know, I really like it." You see how people pray. I mean, I think that even though probably 90% of prayers are petitionary prayers, you know, which is wrong. You know, I remember an old priest, God rest his soul, in Austria, who was, he was giving sermons with rather sort of countrified metaphors. After all, they were country people he was speaking to, and he said, "You know, you treat God like a great big cow. Give, 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 give." I thought, you know, that he was not wrong. Even the Red Book recognizes that, you know. They do not love their neighbor, the people, but they want what is his. Oh, yes. If they were faithful to their love, they would not be greedy. But whoever gives attracts desire. Should they not learn love, fidelity to love, freely will devotion, but they demand and desire and beg from you and have learned no lesson from your awe-inspiring life?" Well, I suppose the imitatio Christi is not very commonly practiced in Christendom. We could certainly agree with that. They have imitated it, there is the imitatio, but they have not lived their own life as you have lived yours. Your awe-inspiring life shows how everyone would have to take their own life into their own hands, faithful to their own essence and their own love. Have you not forgiven the adulteress? Did you not sit with whores and tax collectors? Did you not break the command of the Sabbath? There too, I think it should be commandment. You lived your own life, but men failed to do so. Instead, they pray to you and make demands on you and forever remind you that your work is incomplete. Yet your work would be completed if men managed to live their own lives without imitations. Men are still childish and forget gratitude, since they cannot say, "Thanks be to you, our Lord, for the salvation you have brought us. We have taken it into ourselves, give it a place in our hearts, and we have learned to carry on your work in ourselves on our own. Through your help, we have grown mature in continuing the work of redemption in us. Thanks to you, we have embraced your work." Of course, what he is saying here is, this is what people should be able to say to Jesus Christ. But of course they don't, because instead of that, they are using him as an object of prayer to give them things and to do the work for them that they should be doing themselves, which is, of course, a very common human proclivity. This is, again, through your help, we have grown mature in continuing the work of redemption in us. Thanks to you, we have embraced your work, we have grasped your redemptive teaching, we completed in ourselves what you had begun for us with a bloody struggle. We are not ungrateful children who desire our parents' possessions. Thanks to you, our Master, we will make the most of your talent and will not bury it in the earth and forever stretch out our hands helplessly and urge you to complete your work in us. We want to take your troubles and your work upon ourselves so that your work may be completed and so that you may lay your weary, tired hands in your lap like the worker after a long day's hard burden. Blessed is the dead one who rests from the completion of his work. I wanted people to address you in this way, but they have no love for you, my Master and brother. They begrudge you the price of peace. They leave your work incomplete, eternally needing your pity and your care. But my Master and my brother, I believe you have completed your work, since the one who has given his life, his entire truth, all his love, his entire soul, has completed his work. What one individual can do for men, you have done and accomplished and fulfilled. The time has come when each must do his own work of redemption. Mankind has grown older and a new month has begun. This is a phrase that Philemon repeats. It has been said before, he says a new month. I think Dr. Shamdasani seems to think that it has to do with the Platonic month, periods of time. It may, however, be just a phrase like a new period, a new aeon has begun. Anyways, a new month has begun. When Philemon had finished, I looked up and saw that the place where the shade had stood was empty. I turned to Philemon and said, "My father, you spoke of men. I am a man. Forgive me." In other words, Jung takes it now personally. I mean, you have said how badly people have acted in this situation. Well, I am one of them. You know? But Philemon dissolved into the darkness and decided to do what was required of me. I accepted all the joy and every torment of my nature and remained true to my love to suffer what comes to everyone in their own way. And I stood alone and was afraid. I think this may require a little more exegesis than I have initially given it. The theme occurs again that what human beings need to do is to fall back upon themselves and, as the phrase has it throughout the Red Book, live their life. Now you might say, well, okay, what's so new about that? I'm living my life already, but much of it I don't like very much. And if you had said that, you probably would be quite correct and quite honest. But that is not what is meant. What is meant here really is, I think, a phenomenon that we can more completely understand and grasp by way of some familiarity with the Gnostic scriptures and with the Gnostic tradition to I belong. Because the Gnostic tradition holds that from the very early days of Jesus' career and thereafter, there has always been a message that very largely has been lost. And that message was to the effect that God and the Savior is not only out there, but that it is also inside the human being. And that indeed a very important aspect of the mission of Jesus was to call attention to that, that people should discover the developing, the still nascent but growing God within themselves and live the life with that God. That is living the life. That is the ultimate authenticity, namely to live your life guided and inspired by your true essence, by your true being, which is the spark of the divine within you. That is when you will become truly yourself, and that is the life that you are supposed to lead. And Philemon is quite right. What happened in the history of Christianity? Jesus remained an external figure, still very important, and I'm sure that humankind throughout these 2,000 years would have been, and certainly the West, would have been a lot worse off without that figure. It still has been very, very important. But that part, that very, very important part of the mission of that particular messenger of light, light and life, has not really been taken to heart. Here and there are a few mystics. You read Angelus Silesius, you read Meister Eckhart, you read perhaps Saint Teresa, San Juan de la Cruz, Saint John of the Cross. Yeah, well, they had a grasp of that. You might say that they were living their life as Jesus might have wanted them to live it. But the rest, no. And they are just using the figure of the great messenger and the concept of God to try to get goodies for themselves. And this goes on even when, let's say, the orthodoxy disappeared and we have, oh, I don't know, New Age spirituality, you know, has to be pronounced a certain way, you know, and so forth. Because what happens there? There again, I mean, this of course has been with us since the 19th century with what I like to call the metafizzlers, you know. Well, the metafizzlers of course say that God is like a big warehouse and all the stuff that you could possibly want is there. And if you can sort of fiddle with the lock a bit, then you can get it, see? And it'll all come to you. All the goodies imaginable. Now, once again, I'm not disputing that some of that cannot be done. I'm disputing whether it's really legitimate to do so, number one, and secondly, that it avails you much in the long run. Probably doesn't. And when, certainly from a Gnostic point of view, and Jung's is a Gnostic point of view, it may not be the exact Gnostic point of view as we know the scriptures of 2,000 years ago, but it is certainly a form of gnosis and a Gnostic point of view. And in this respect, Jung is exactly on the same wavelength as the ancient Gnostics. He said, look, this being has come to call attention to the deific potential within yourself and has called you to lead an authentic life of your own indwelling divinity, of your own indwelling power. And yet, all these 2,000 years, only very few have done it. And this is indeed, as I perhaps will have the opportunity to explain later, maybe in the next lecture, this is indeed one of the big, big points in the message of the Red Book. That this is what needs to be done. And that is why this is the Liber Novus, the new book. And you might almost say perhaps the Gnosis Novus, the new Gnosis. Because it tries to tell us that what we have been doing so far is insufficient. And indeed, the secularization, which certainly was going on in Jung's day already and has reached monumental proportions since then, of Europe and of the West. In Jung's day, it was mostly the intellectuals. It was mostly sort of an intellectual elite of the culture who were getting secularized. And these are the ones, as Jung himself has said, whom he addressed. He said very often, I have nothing to say. That was now Jung the psychologist, not Philemon, you know. Jung said, I have nothing to say of people who really have a genuine religious faith and practice, because they are okay, they are doing in their own way what needs to be done. That's why he said at his time, he was talking in the 1930s, I think, when he said this, he said, Catholics don't need me, because they have the confessional. Mm-hmm. Well, things have changed. I'm afraid that probably Catholics need him now too, because, well, let's say things have changed, both in terms of people and also in terms of the church. So that is why the secularization has progressed, because the need for the authentic life is not met. And the time has come, it's another month, it's another aeon now, when the leading of this authentic life becomes imperative. Where we can no longer get away with anything else. If we don't manage to do that, we are lost. And this is absolutely and definitely part of the message of the Red Book. Now, everybody is free to accept it or reject it, or to linger somewhere between acceptance and rejection, but it is definitely there, and you see it here. So this is certainly now a most significant passage. And the next figure to appear is very different. He's of Middle Eastern appearance. He wears a turban, and his message is, my word, about women, hopefully not about the 72 virgins, or the 172-year-old virgin, I don't know. That's an alternative, you know, you have to keep that in mind. But let's withdraw from Islamic studies now. He says that women are healers because they learn how to heal their children. He says that he ought to pay, namely Jung, ought to pay less attention to his bleeding from the thousandfold wounds of men, but men here again means humans, you know, and he ought to pay attention to joy, especially that may come to him by way of women. Now, that's a comforting message. As he gets ready to argue with the old Turk, as he calls him, the turbaned one changes and reveals himself as, you guessed it maybe, Philemon again. Philemon is a shape changer like good magicians. Philemon then discourses with him further, and Jung interprets Philemon's words by referring to love. He understands that love must be freed from, as he calls it, commingling that arises through unlived love. Most likely he refers to repressed sexuality and repressed romantic emotionalism, which, unless understood and rendered harmless, otherwise commingles with, you know, more authentic and more useful and more lasting love, and becomes a form of unconsciousness and unconscious bondage. That word is used here. So what Philemon in disguise here tells him, yes, you know, this is very important and you can gain a great deal in your life, he tells Jung, through the love of women, but you must learn to disentangle your relationship and your love from all kinds of unconscious and repressed stuff that has been bothering you before, because then it is not going to work that way. And of course it is rather well known to anyone who is familiar to some degree with Jung's life, that the women, both his wife Emma and then his great friend Antonia Wolf, but a whole bunch of other people, that the women disciples, the women friends and so forth, were extremely important in Jung's career. There are various reasons for that which really don't concern us here. And then follows a most significant passage. On a night when everything was silent, I heard a murmur like that of many voices, and a bit more clearly I heard the voice of Philemon, and it was as if he were giving a speech. And as I listened more closely, I heard his words. Afterward, when I had impregnated the dead body of the underworld, this is quotation now, and when it had given birth to the serpent of the god, I went to men and saw the fullness of their affliction and their madness. I saw that they were slaying each other, and that they sought the grounds for their actions. They did this because they did not have anything different or better to do. You know, when we, even at the individual level, when we hear the reports, the newscasts and so forth nowadays, when all kinds of crazy murderous things occur, I'm sure that they have occurred at other times too, we are reminded of that. People kill each other mainly because they don't have anything better to do. It's a form of present-day entertainment, and certainly one of the more baneful ones. But because they were accustomed to doing nothing for which they could not account, they devised reasons that compelled them to go on killing. Stop. You are out of your minds, said the sage. Stop, for heaven's sakes, and take stock of what damage you have done, said the canny one. But the fool laughed, since honors had been conferred upon him overnight. Why do men not see their stupidity? Well, now here is a big question, folks. Stupidity is a daughter of the god. Therefore men cannot stop murdering, since thus they serve the serpent of the god without knowing it. It is worth giving one's life for the sake of serving the serpent of the god. Hence be reconciled, but it would be far better to live despite all of that. But these lower serpents want human blood. This feeds the serpent, makes it shine. Not wanting to murder and die amounts to deceiving the dark gods. Whoever lives has become one who deceives the god. Whoever lives invents his life for himself. Here again, this is the whoever lives his life, as previously indicated. That is the one who can withdraw from the, the murderous mass psychosis of humanity. The greater the number of men who stole their lives from the gods, the greater the harvest feeding the serpent from the blood-sown field. The God grows strong through human murder. The serpent grows hot and fiery through the drenching flood. Its fat burns in the blazing flame. The flame becomes the light of men, the first ray of a renewed sun. He, the first appearing light. Okay. Among others, the statement is made later on that Jesus' work of redemption must now be replaced by every man doing his own redemption. A new month, as we have heard before, means a new aeon. Rather like the, as I mentioned, the Platonic month. Once again, living one's life, you know, ultimate authenticity are emphasized. Significant also is Philemon's reverent acknowledgement of the greatness and the work of Jesus, who is initially introduced as wearing a robe of grandeur. Next, Jung has this fairly lengthy sermon delivered by Philemon, of which I read a portion to you now. Philemon says that after performing certain theurgic acts, which I mentioned, in the underworld, he came to see with much horror what he calls the fullness of the affliction and madness of humans. Among these, the chief one being that they are forever slaying each other. Though people really go on killing each other because they do not have anything different or better to do, however, they devise reasons to go on killing, which are not really true reasons. According to Philemon's account, there are what we might call archetypal reasons. That's why he speaks of this fiery serpent. You know, whenever he mentions the God and the gods, you need to remember he's not referring here to the monotheistic God. He's basically referring to archetypal beings, to archetypal gods, who are rather like the gods of antiquity, but who compel humans to do various things. A fiery serpent, who is called the daughter of the God, becomes bloodthirsty. And then human stupidity and weakness yields to this fiery serpent, who eventually begins to burn in his own fire, and from this fire there arises a new light, which is a light, the first ray of the renewed sun. It is difficult to say with certainty what this refers to, but considering that these words are written in 1916, or very close to it, they may well refer to the horrors of the slaughter of World War I, which was justly called the Great War, because it surpassed in slaughter all other wars, including the most traumatic war prior to that time, the Napoleonic Wars, 100 years previously. Now, Jung meets an old acquaintance, whom he encountered under very dramatic circumstances earlier in the Red Book, namely Elijah. And you may recall Elijah and Salome were his first encounter with sort of this archetypal initiatory couple. And it was very dramatic and was very powerful. But as he looks at Elijah, Elijah doesn't look very good. He looks rather debilitated and aged. Well, it happens to the best of us. The first new encounter occurs in a dream, and thus Jung says that he called Elijah and Salome so that they would answer my questions. This indicates a transgressive relationship between Jung's dreams and his visions. By this time, sometimes it's a dream, and that one leads then again to a greater vision. So the evoked entities appear, and Elijah steps forward. He complains that Jung has taken too much of his power. He says, "You took too much from me. You went too far away from me," he says. Then he complains that he has heard voices full of confusion, an alarmed voice full of warning, and the incomprehensible statements. Some of these communications, he says, frightening images of much blood, some of it flowing from a wine press. This is Elijah talking now. Then he voices his chief complaint, a malicious word that was about the death of God. Now you may recall that in the sermons to the dead, it comes up, the dead says, is God dead? And there are other statements here and there. Of course, the term God is dead was something that Friedrich Nietzsche has, in a somewhat sensationalistic manner, popularized around that time. However, we need to remember that while Nietzsche had a way of very poetically overstating things, I remember when I at one of my early philosophy classes, a professor said, you know, you have to realize that Nietzsche isn't really that much a philosopher. Nietzsche is a poet. And I think that was true. But let's say while he made a big splash with the term God is dead, in various ways that sentence and that concept has been going around, especially since then. You may recall that, oh dear, it must have been the 1960s that developed a whole kind of little school, all composed of preachers, all composed of ministers, the death of God theology, you know. And I always considered it funny that the preachers are talking about the death of God, thereby putting themselves out of business, you know. But, you know, Altheiser and Hamilton of Stanford and various others. And I think Altheiser and Hamilton and the sort of the death of God theologians, I think they got an idea very similar to Jung's, that what is dead or what is dying is a particular God concept. It's a particular God image, and which is, for the most part, the Judeo-Christian Islamic, although don't tell this to the Muslim Brotherhood, but let's say a God concept of the monotheistic God as it has been, you know, envisioned for a long time. That somehow that way of envisioning and dealing with deity is not a live proposition any longer. But certainly Elijah apparently heard this, and he doesn't very much like it. Now, if Elijah had looked into the seven sermons as we looked in the last couple of lectures, he would have seen that Philemon says that God is not dead. God is as alive as ever, but then he explains what kind of God he is talking about. But Elijah here is not very happy. So Jung argues with Elijah. What else? Elijah concludes by saying there is only one God and God cannot die, which is certainly a statement that an awful lot of people would make. And Jung reproaches him by saying that many things had happened that Elijah seems to ignore. Among these is that the one God has gone away, and many gods and many daemons have come to humanity. He voices amazement that Elijah, who has the power of foresight, that knows the future, yet knows nothing of the new developments of the present. Now what may he be talking about? In a sense, certainly metaphorically one might say, that a god is someone, some being, or real or imagined, that people worship, that people are very fond of, are very reverent of, and so forth. So what Jung is saying is that as in earlier historical times, people were worshipping God. Now, with the coming of a secular age, they worship all kinds of lesser beings and things, including their own greed, you know, material things, and their mental obsessions. Those are their gods. Health is one of the gods of our culture right now. Oh, the sin of all sins is second-hand smoke. I mean, you know, this is worse than mass murder, you know. And on the other hand, various other things, and certainly, you know, I am not a right-to-lifer, but let's say things that in previous ages were, for the most part, from certain time on, kind of the 11th century on, considered pretty reprehensible, like abortion, that's all right. But to light up a cigarette, that's the sin of all sins, and so forth. So what are these? These are the new gods and the new demons. Everything that we project and we make a big deal out of, and that ultimately reveals itself as really rather trivial. But while the worship goes on, it's very, very powerful. And then, you know, we could go on about that. I mean, political ideology, which was the great demon of the 20th century, and hopefully will wane in the 21st. I mean, that was the god of the Nazis. You know, it wasn't Hitler as rather this nebulous, cruel, bloodthirsty ideology that Hitler was putting forth. Same with Stalin and so forth. It wasn't the people. It was a big demonic force, I am not hesitant to say so, behind them, which, however, people worshipped as if it was a deity. And it goes on. So we have all of these gods and demons now which have replaced the previous deity, the previous god image. And so Jung is trying to tell that to Elijah. He says, you know, look around, look what's going on. People are worshipping all of these ideas and these things and so forth. That's what has happened. And then he asks Elijah, do you ultimately deny what is? In other words, you are not paying attention to what is taking place in the world today. You are only looking, being a prophet, Elijah, he's looks into the future, but not into the present. And then Salome, who has been pretty quiet up till now, explains that Elijah looks only to the future. He does not look at the past. And Jung then discourses further with Elijah and Salome, both of whom seem to be greatly attached to the monotheistic God image. After all, they come from the Old Testament, and they do not wish to deal with the more multi-centered images of reality that have arisen and that are still with us. Jung tells the archetypal couple that the one does not exclude the many. Quite important. And, you know, you can see how that periodically came to be implemented in the history of religion, history of Christendom, for instance. Christendom, of course, I mean, it started out as a Jewish heresy, so it's a monotheistic, comes from a monotheistic matrix. But then, as history went on, let's say it became enriched with what? With an almost pantheon of saints, with hierarchies and hierarchies of angels and so forth. So you had the one, but you also had the many. Of course, the rigid monotheists always jump into the picture, and that was the Protestants. They said, you've got to do away with all of that, you know. It's only one God, and maybe Christ, if he's lucky. You know. However, the one and the many are both realities. They are not mutually exclusive, either theologically or psychologically. But I don't think old Elijah is too comfortable with that concept at all. And he presents Elijah and Salome with a truly Gnostic kind of paradox. This is Jung talking to them. The multiplicity of individual things is the one, multiple God, from whose body many gods arise. But the uniqueness of the one thing is the other God, whose body is man, but whose spirit is as large as the world. Full of paradoxes, But perhaps these issues are best expressed in paradoxes. Elijah, however, is unwilling to deal with this concept, and he seeks refuge in the idea that the present is really without reality. Only the past and the future matter. It's maybe a little bit like that old trite little poem, which I may or may not be able to recall. Be not concerned with the future, because the present is all thou hast. The future will soon be present. The present will soon be past. So this is somewhere along those lines, only Elijah looks at it a bit differently. And so Elijah is unwilling to deal with this. And with this rumination, he calls to Salome and is about to depart. He says, come on, woman, let's go. You know, this guy, Jung, he tells too many things that we don't like. Salome, however, and you know, she always had a soft spot in her heart for Jung from the beginning. And I think she was always sad that Jung is one of the guys who got away. So she whispers to Jung that she really sympathizes with his point of view. She says to him as she departs, being and multiplicity appeal to me, even it is not new and not eternally true. So once again, I think here also Jung's position certainly approaches the Gnostic position, where multiplicity is grounded in oneness, where the one emanates itself in a multiplicity of aeonial beings and ultimately in physical beings as well. The rigid monotheistic image derived from the Old Testament was obnoxious to the ancient Gnostics and to Jung, the modern Gnostic, also. Now, after Elijah and Salome's departure, Jung says he returned to the burden signified by his existence. Now, this is something that I want to memorize, so that, like, when I leave here, or, you know, I leave the company of my friends or things that I trudge toward home, it means I am returning to the burden signified by my existence. And though he tried to do everything correctly, he's basically referring to his career, his life, his work as a doctor. He tried to do everything correctly and properly, but he became filled once again with anxious dreams, and he did not know why. Then his soul, his old friend, and the one whom he likes to argue with, one of the several he likes to argue with, his soul came to him one night, as if worried, and said to him, listen to me, I am in great torment. The son of the dark womb besieges me. Therefore, your dreams are also difficult, since you feel the torment of the depths, the pain of your soul, and the suffering of the gods. Jung offers his help, although he questions whether as a man he ought to act as a mediator of souls and gods. She also tells him that in effect he can help men, humans, only through the gods, not directly. The soul continues to insist that he must help the gods, whose present torment has in fact been caused by Jung himself. And the soul says, you have left them with torment. Since then they have suffered. The soul continues to implore Jung to be unconditionally obedient to the gods and demons. But Jung continues to resist in a stout manner. Finally, the soul leaves, but returns after sending a frightening dream to intimidate him. These are the sort of things that souls do, you know. In the following night, Jung calls upon his soul again, and lo, the soul reports that the gods have given in to the rebellious Jung. The soul ends her discourse by addressing Jung thus, the gods have mercy upon you and have accepted your sacrifice. Now, what may we say is the meaning of this dialogue? How and what are the gods whose request for unconditional obedience Jung refused? Likely answer might be that the gods stand for archetypes of the collective unconscious, to use a later Jungian term, who have a tendency to possess humans. The individuated human will not allow his consciousness to be subordinated by archetypes. Unconscious or partially conscious people are victimized by the unconscious and its denizens. So that when, you know, people without the requisite inner psycho-spiritual development have the kind of encounters that Jung has in the Red Book, or even just something approximating that, well, not only may they become unhinged, but they become sort of, you know, possessed by the archetypal influences, by the archetypal beings. And they lose their sovereignty. They are being pushed around. They are being sent here, sent there. They are inspired to write stupid things. You know, they predict the end of the world very soon. Or all kinds of things like that. You know, you have all encountered, maybe you for a little while, hopefully only you have been in that spot yourself, where you are not really yourself. But what is taking over you seems like something very great and very good and very wise, but it's not you. So therefore you have to keep your distance. You can learn from these beings and from these experiences, but you should not give up your own sovereignty, your own individuation, because when you do, you're really subverting the entire desirable process, because the end result of all of these developments should be that you become your real self and then begin to lead your real life, not somebody else's. So that's kind of the situation that is going on here. So Jung considered this being taken over as an undesirable condition, and so by holding his own, he acted as an individuated person ought to act. Archetypal possession can take many forms, including religious fanaticism, like today's religious terrorists, or a fanatical service of one's ideas, as one finds among would-be revolutionaries and social reformers of the ilk of the Nazi and communist dictators. Now follows a most revealing passage which gives additional information about Philemon's identity and about the relationship of Philemon to aspects of the Christian tradition and once again to Christ himself. This, in many ways, I think, is one of the most dramatic portions and passages of the entire Red Book. It was noon on a hot summer's day, and I was taking a stroll in my garden when I reached the shade of the high trees. I met Philemon strolling in the fragrant grass. But when I sought to approach him, a blue shade came from the other side, and when Philemon saw him, he said, "I find you in the garden, beloved. The sins of the world have conferred beauty upon your countenance. The suffering of the world has straightened your shape. You are truly a king. Your crimson is blood. Your ermine is snow from the coldness of the poles. Your crown is the heavenly body of the sun, which you bear on your head. Welcome to the garden, my master, my beloved, my brother." You can probably connect this with the earlier event and know who he's talking about. Now the shade replies, "O Simon Magus, or whatever name you choose to wear now, are you in my garden or am I in yours?" Philemon said, "You are, O master, in my garden. Helena, or whatever you choose to call her today, and I are your servants. You can find accommodation with us. Simon and Helena have become Philemon and Baucis, and so we are the hosts of the gods. we granted hospitality to you and also before you to the terrible worm. The terrible worm is the dragon. You know, in German, worm, historically, is frequently a dragon. Lindwurm is another word for a dragon. And the dragon, Draco, or Dracula, which comes from that also, is the demon. You know, the terrible worm has been there too. And since you come forward, we take you in. It is our garden that surrounds you. The shade answered, is this garden not mine? Is not the world of the heavens and of the spirits my own? Philemon said, you are, O master, here in the world of men now. Men have changed. They are no longer the slaves and no longer the swindlers of the gods, and no longer mourn in your name, but they grant hospitality to the gods. The terrible worm came here before you, whom you recognize as your brother insofar as you are of celestial nature, and as your father insofar as you are of human nature. You dismissed him when he gave you clever counsel in the desert. Jesus' encounter in the desert in the 40 days, you know. You took the counsel but dismissed the worm. He finds a place with us. Philemon doesn't seem to be all that happy about him, but he says here he is. But where he is, you will be also. When I was Simon, I sought to escape him with the ploy of magic, and thus I escaped you. Now that I gave the worm a place in my garden, you come to me also. And then there is little other section, and then Philemon. Philemon said, recognize, O my master and beloved, that your nature also has that of the serpent. Were you not raised on the tree like the serpent, put up on the tree? Have you laid aside your body like the serpent, its skin, the resurrection, you know? Have you not practiced the healing arts like the serpent? The serpent, the caduceus, is the symbol of healing. Did you not go down to hell before your ascent? That is the harrowing of hell, you know, at Easter time. And did you not see your brother, the worm, there, who was shut away in the abyss? Then the shade said, you speak the truth, you are not lying. Even so, do you know what I bring you? This I know not, Philemon answered. I know only one thing, that whoever hosts the worm also needs his divine brother. What do you bring me, my beautiful guest? Lamentation and abomination were the gift of the worm. What will you give us? The shade answered, I bring you the beauty of suffering. That is what is needed by whoever hosts the worm. And those, my friends, are the last words of the actual text of the Red Book. However, our work is not done. Jung sees a blue shade in the garden. This shade is the shade of Jesus, who appeared earlier in his robe of glory. Why shade? Because Jesus, having ascended, has no physical form. Philemon welcomes the shade of Jesus with reverent words, and Jesus recognizes him as Simon Magus. Now, Simon Magus was a teacher, just to recollect, from Samaria in the first century. According to all indications, he is rightly regarded as the first Gnostic. He is unfavorably mentioned in the Acts of the Apostles in the New Testament, where he is called a magician. And it is said that he wished to purchase magical powers from the apostles. Jung regarded the Acts of the Apostles' accounts of Simon, by the way, as a malicious caricature. Many statements of Jung indicate that he had a high regard for Simon. These statements are now readily understandable, since he knew Philemon to be identical with Simon. Philemon introduces to the shade of Jesus the idea that with the passage of time people have changed, and the issues of religion of Jesus' time for the most part no longer obtain. He, Philemon himself, who no longer is Simon, but rather he and his consort Helen have become Philemon and Baucis. Now, Simon and Helen have been called by various people the archetypal Gnostic couple. Now, we don't need to say much more about it, but Simon said that he found Helen, who was an aspect and the embodiment of the anima mundi, of the world soul, and who has previously lived as Helen of Troy. And she became then his companion and was with him all throughout his many journeys throughout the Mediterranean region. Now, the legend of Philemon and Baucis is an old Greek legend, and I spoke about it once before, and Philemon and Baucis are a venerable couple who own a house, and I don't want to go into all the details, but in any event, the gods come around, as they used to in Greece, and come to visit people, but no, it was a group of gods, and nobody would let them in. I think the Greeks didn't want to share their dolma and their baklava with anybody that day. Philemon and Baucis were the only ones who let them in. And so great blessings and prominence were bestowed on them. Then there's a variety on the theme, because Philemon and Baucis appear again in the different context in Goethe's Faust, the second part of the Faust. And you need to remember that to people like Jung and indeed Freud and many others, the Faust is a sort of sacred scripture. I mean, everybody was reading the Faust. Sigmund Freud never went anywhere on his travels without a copy of Goethe's Faust, which he took with him. So, you know, that brought, let's say, the figure of Philemon and Baucis to the attention of particularly German-speaking peoples. But that's just a matter of explanation. In any event, you know, there is a connection between the legend of Philemon and the Philemon of Jung of the Red Book. But the connection, I think, is primarily that Philemon is the archetype of a person, of a being who does what? Who lets the gods in. So when you open your door and you let the gods in, who are there knocking at the door, then you become a very important emissary of the gods, as indeed Philemon is here. Now, there are some other curious elements here. The rest of the, at least the first part of the speech addressed to Jesus concerns the need to address evil, which is the other big, I'm taking my thunder away from next week, but of course next week I intend to speak about these. It is the need to address oneself to evil, to recognize the shadow, to become familiar with the shadow. And it was Jung's view, and it's certainly true up to a considerable extent, that one of Christendom's great failings was that it did not really address evil, and did not address evil in a manner in which it should have been addressed. And I'm not going to go into how it should have been addressed at this point. But Jung went on record saying that the only ones who took evil seriously were the Gnostics. And so that Christendom not having understood and not having addressed the nature of the dark power, just was afraid of it, justly, but still, to be afraid of something of which you have no real understanding makes the fear that much worse and that much more destructive. There are some things that we justly fear, think I justly fear a big Mack truck coming down the road when I'm in the middle of the road and I try to get out of the way. But if I did not know that that was a Mack truck that could run me down, then I would perish. So you need to understand the danger, you need to understand the evil as much as possible, and then that allows you to deal with the situation in an intelligent way. So it was Jung's feeling, his view, that Christendom did not do that. And that is why here he is really not so much talking about the actual mission of Christ. He knew better than that, but he said, you know, you told the devil to get out, to get behind you in the desert when he talked to you and so on. That's what your followers did. They didn't look. They did not understand. They just rejected evil. And that became the cause of a lot of trouble and a lot of difficulties throughout Christian history. The terrible worm is Satan. Now, we also need to keep in mind that in certain early Christian groups, some of them related to Gnostics, sort of Gnosticizing groups, there was also a myth that Satan was the brother of Christ, that they were in heaven together, but that Satan fell and went down, was cast into the abyss, while Christ came eventually and tried to help the situation, but that the two are closely connected. And that is where he says here that the worm is your brother, and as we here, as Philemon, has admitted the worm to the garden, which means that he is dealing with evil. He is bringing it into the view and dealing with it, and therefore the good one can also come into the garden, because there is always a sort of a connection between the two. So Philemon employs the serpent symbolism applied to Jesus. And this, of course, definitely goes back to early times. The story of Exodus with the brazen serpent of Moses has been taken as a prefiguration of Christ in all of classical Christian theology. And definitely in some early times, the serpent on the cross was regarded as the agathodaimon, the good spirit Christ on the cross. And there are many, many applications of this, but there are many very early iconographical representations of the serpent on the cross. So Philemon says that he has given place to the worm in his garden, and thus his brother Jesus could come also. And then Jesus says that he brought the beauty of suffering. Now, this is very hard to explain, but perhaps a transfiguration of the experience of suffering, a way of rising out of suffering by way of the experience of suffering itself, is something to consider. Now, that also is part of Christian theology for quite a long time, and the way it is usually explained there has never been very pleasing to me, and I think that behind it lurks some more profound truth, but it's so profound that I don't know it, so I can't tell you. But the frequent way in which this is explained is that Jesus suffered on the cross, Calvary. And that, therefore, when individual people suffer, they can offer their suffering to a similar end for the work of salvation. And then it's sort of your suffering is united with the suffering of the Savior. Well, okay, there may be something to it. There was, incidentally, a Hindu teacher, very famous, one of the two or three greatest gurus in modern times, Ramana Maharshi, who had a very similar idea and who taught it. Ramana Maharshi himself was suffering for a long time and died of a pretty painful form of the cancer of the throat. And he said that one can transmute one's suffering for the removal of the karma and for the salvation of the world. Well, It is possible, but it's not something that I have real knowledge of or that I can greatly sympathize with. Now, let me read to you what is called in the Red Book the epilogue, which actually occurs in the calligraphic copy at the end in Liber Novus, and this is how it reads. It's dated 1959. So it's, what, about 4 years prior to Jung's death. I worked on this book for 16 years. My acquaintance with alchemy in 1930 took me away from it. The beginning of the end came in 1928 when Wilhelm, that is Richard Wilhelm, the sinologist, the great Chinese scholar, sent me the text of the Golden Flower, an alchemical treatise. It's had been published under the name The Secret of the Golden Flower. Perhaps you're familiar with it. It's a treatise on Chinese alchemy. There, the contents of this book found their way into actuality. Of this book found its way into actuality in The Secret of the Golden Flower. That's what he's saying. So we need to start our alchemical series with The Secret of the Golden Flower. I haven't spoken about it for about 30 years or so. The contents of this book found their way into actuality and could no longer continue working on it, that being this book. To the superficial observer, it will appear like madness. It would also have developed into madness, had I not been able to absorb the overpowering force of the original experiences. With the help of alchemy, I could finally arrange them into a whole. I always knew that these experiences contained something precious. That's the experiences in the Red Book. And therefore, I knew of nothing better than to write them down in a precious, that is to say, costly book, and to paint the images that emerged through reliving it all as well as I could. I knew how frightfully inadequate this undertaking was, but despite much work and many distractions, I remained true to it. And then it says, even if another possibility never, and the sentence breaks off, and he did not continue with the sentence. Now, few more minutes, bear with me. The Red Book, as published at this time, contains 3 appendices. Appendix 1 is purely pictorial. It contains 8 mandala sketches, 7 dated in 1917 and 1 undated. There is also a preliminary sketch of his great design called Systema Mundi Totius, of which I say more in a minute, and a somewhat incomplete sketch of a Babylonian text originally intended for the first page of Book 2 of the Red Book. Finally, there is the extremely elaborate and colorful circular mandala. I will open the book to it so you can see it. Circular mandala diagram entitled Systema Mundi Totius, which means the system of the entire world. It is largely based on the 7 sermons of the dead, encompassing all realms of reality verbally alluded to in the 7 sermons. It has pleroma outside the outermost circle, and several concentric circles surrounding an inner core, a microcosm. And Dr. Shandasani says that it's to be envisioned that when you come to the center, everything becomes smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, and your consciousness goes there into the smallness. Outside is the greatness. And there are several concentric circles. The outermost circle divided into segments of 4 colors, the outermost one, is called Mundus Exterior Major, meaning the larger outer world. At the bottom is the form of the way Jung envisioned Abraxas at that time. It's called Abraxas Dominus Mundi, Abraxas the Lord of the World, a being with the head of a lion and the body of the spirit. In this context, he appears as a definite demiurge, as the editor calls him a world creator of an ambivalent nature. And this is a diagram of the Gnostic cosmology described in the seven sermons. All right. Appendix B is entitled Commentaries and is taken from Jung's corrected draft of the Red Book. You know, the writing of the Red Book proceeded in stages of visions were written down first in the little books that were called the Black Books, and there are several of those, at least seven, I think more. Some of those will be in the exhibit that we may see in April. From there it was transcribed into a draft. The draft was then typed, and each time Jung corrected it and changed it some, and then he wrote it with his calligraphy into the Red Book. So it was quite an intricate process in several stages. This Appendix B in the book is an attempt to create commentaries out of what appeared to have been a sort of secondary visions, which Jung called mystery play. He did not include it in the calligraphic text, and perhaps for good reasons, for nowhere do these images approximate, in my estimation, the power and the compelling beauty of the accounts in the Liber Novus, in the Red Book proper. Appendix C is an entry from Black Book number 5, which according to the editor gives a preliminary sketch of the cosmology of the Septem Sermones. On the whole, it contains themes which appear in greater volume and greater lucidity in the seven sermons themselves. Just to give you the idea what they are like, I will read to you just one paragraph from this appendix, which is sort of the statement of the soul about this material, and that's at the very end. I, your soul, am your mother, who tenderly and frightfully surrounds you, your nourisher and corrupter. I prepare good things and poison for you. I am your intercessor with Abraxas. I teach you the arts that protect you from Abraxas. I stand between you and Abraxas, the all-encompassing. I am your body, your shadow, your effectiveness in this world, your manifestation in the world of the gods, your effulgence, your breath, your odor, your magical force. You should call me if you want to live with men, but the one, and the one is in italics, the one God if you want to rise above the human world to the divine and eternal solitude of the star. This, of course, harkens back to the seventh sermon. And I think with that we conclude our ruminations in the text of the Red Book itself, an evaluation of the Red Book material, and certain hints, statements given by Jung himself as to how best deal with this kind of material, how to gain the kind of inspiration that we need in his famous essay on the transcendent function will follow. And meanwhile, I thank you so very much and hope that you'll be with us on the concluding.
Copyright MMM by DC Recordings, catalog number 200512. For more information about available lecture titles and for many other resources, visit gnosis.org. That's GNOSIS.ORG.